Pull up a chair, the stories begin. Patrick and Randy are letting you in. From the desert lights where the big names are, it's Big Conversations, Little Bar.
Welcome to Big Conversations, Little Bar, the Coachella Valley's favorite podcast, recorded live at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert. Get ready for another fascinating hour of meeting people who make the desert city such a spectacular place to be. Now, nestled in their corner booth perch, well lubricated and raring to chat, here's Patrick Evans and Randy Florence.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that is the voice of Howard Hoffman, and we are here. My name is Patrick Evans. We're at Skip Page's Little Bar for another edition of Big Conversations, Little Bar. My co-host Randy Florence is here, as always.
Your voice sounds really sexy today.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, I know. You're drinking the hot toddy.
I got the hot toddy going. Yeah.
It's a good look.
Thanks. Thanks.
You and a hot toddy is a good look. Hey, when this airs, it'll be a couple of weeks past. But I hope you got a chance to watch the halftime show at the Super Bowl yesterday.
I did, of course.
Wasn't it amazing?
It was very good.
I thought it was fantastic. Once I told somebody last night, I didn't understand a single word he said, but well, I understood
every
word
yes,
he said.
Yes, I saw your post.
Oh, you saw that.
Yeah,
good.
I did.
I wanted to repeat it out loud.
Okay.
I thought it was fantastic. John, did you like it?
I loved the game. I actually didn't see the halftime show. I'm looking forward to watching it recorded. In fact, I only saw the last 5 minutes of the game.
Because you won't watch a whole game. Because you're afraid of cursing your Seattle Seahawks.
That's part of it, but I was also busy editing the episode that we actually released today during the show or during the football game, so I didn't have it on until the end.
Well, at least
you
have your priorities in place. That's important.
Right.
And congratulations. Your team beat my team. So I had to root for your team yesterday.
Well, you were a fan of the Patriots?
No.
Oh.
I'm a 49ers fan.
Oh, yeah, but they weren't even there.
Your team beat my team, so I had to root for your team.
Oh, okay.
Of course.
There you go.
Yeah,
because the 49ers, start this over?
The 49ers haven't been in a Super Bowl for some time.
It's been quite a while.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I hate to point that out.
And yet you did.
I was just happy to see Seattle get back from what they lost in, 2016?
Oh, 15? Yeah, I was hoping for that play at the 1 yard line again.
Well, that was a dumb call.
Stupidest call infamy. Ever.
It was the stupidest call. But last night, I don't even think that the Patriots really, I mean, they didn't show up until the second half.
And they didn't really show up much for that. One point, I told my wife, it's boring. I'm turning it off. And then all of a sudden, she goes, hey, everybody sounds excited. I go, maybe things are turning around. And then he threw the interception. And I said, nope, it's boring again, honey. We're done.
It was a very deep, but yeah, I will give you great kudos. Seattle's defense was incredible.
Yeah, way to go, John.
I know you did a great job coaching.
Thank you.
Way to put that together, John.
Yeah. Get out of here, Mr. McDonald. Mr. McMullen is taking over.
Right, McMullen. Today we have a really incredible guest, and I've been looking forward to this. Ron Eiswanger is a screenwriter and director, hails from a small town in Pennsylvania.
Very small.
Clarksville.
About 500 people, I think, at its height.
Wow.
And I was related to half of them.
That's, probably, that's why you had to leave.
Interesting to say, actually. Maybe that's why I turned out the way I am.
Well, we got an hour to find out what that meant.
Yes. Welcome to the program. Thanks
Thank
for coming
so
in and doing this.
Thanks.
First of all, you're a recent relocator to the Coachella Valley.
I am.
So I
own real estate in the Coachella Valley.
Thank you.
Last June. How about that?
That's great. So what brought you, what made you make that decision?
Well, I love Palm Springs, and becoming out here for 25 years at least, I think whenever I'd visit LA, I used to live in upstate New York, and I would make a trek out here, but staying in hotels, which I actually do like hotels and have some great hotels.
Oh, yeah.
I've sort of done from the top to the not quite the top. I did the Horizon, been there. I love Sparrow's Lodge.
Oh, yeah.
The Parker. depending on who I was dating and who I was treating to a weekend in a place. So I rated them according to what hotel we were
in. I like that.
Is this person Parker worthy? No.
Parker, you had to be pretty top notch.
Yeah.
Because that's not a cheap weekend.
This is an NBC Suites.
I can't afford the valet at the Parker, let alone a...
That's a good point.
Yeah, so... I just knew a couple of years ago that I was going to end up here, that I was going to, I feel so much peace here when I get into Palm Springs, when I see those beautiful mountains.
Yeah.
I actually have a house in northern Palm Springs that has a giant back pool yard area with an unobstructed, meaning no electric cables,
wow. View
of that beautiful mountain.
Oh my gosh.
And I walked out there and I saw it. I said to my real estate guy, we don't need to go anywhere else.
Oh.
And here we are.
Most of our guests end up bringing us back to their house at some point to see it. So
yeah, especially ones with big pools. We have
giant pools with unobstructed views.
I haven't been heating the pool because it is so expensive. So I'm warning, you might get a little shock.
Probably would. When you moved here, did you have a group of friends or stuff that you used to come and see when you'd visit the valley?
I do have friends here. I'm very happy to say I have a friend that I've known for 27 years who also used to live in upstate New York. We lived near the famous town of Woodstock, the Hudson Valley. And so I've known Larry for a long time, and he and his partner, Elliot, moved here about 4 years ago. And so I had family already here.
Nice.
I know I was introduced to a bunch of people about 2 years ago by your most frequent guest, Michael Childers.
Michael Childers,
the icon.
Yep.
Michael Childers, who I was told by a mutual friend was raving about a show that I had on television called Fellow Travelers, and I'm not really this kind of person, but I wrote to him. I got his email address, and I said, "Dear Mr. Childers, I always regretted that I never met John Schlesinger, your husband, and you're such a great photographer, and I hear you love my show, and if you'd ever like to have a cup of coffee, I'm coming down to Palm Springs for the holidays." This was a couple of years ago, and Michael wrote back, it is so typical, this is an email, it said, "December 26th, lunch or dinner." That's it.
That's the only date available you're going to do there.
And I said, lunch, and I went, and he introduced me to some wonderful people, and then my circle's been growing.
Nice.
Yeah, and with him at the center of it, it's a very fascinating.
Well, his Rolodex is the most extensive Rolodex in the world. And he knows everybody.
Yeah, it could almost be a party game. Let's mention a person, a famous person from the 20th century, and see if Michael would ever say, "Oh, gee, I never met them." Because it's never happened yet.
I don't see
yet.
That happening.
It's never happened yet.
No, you don't know what he's going to say, though.
Well, even if you ask that question.
Yeah.
He did tell us when he was here most recently about his being introduced to adult pleasures as a 15-year-old in the balcony of the Plaza Theater when it was originally around.
He told me that his mother thought he was being taken well care of, or his grandmother. I think his grandmother.
It was his grandmother.
They just talked about the movie theater, and we know Michael's all fine for a few hours, and he certainly was
better than fine. Better than fine, I'd say.
That's
a good day at the movies. Beats the hell out of popcorn.
I'm not spending enough time in the balcony. Damn it.
But imagine being that life. And my life isn't as celebrity laden as Michael's is, although it is a fairly long list over my career of people that I either have glancingly met or actually worked with. But to be as Michael was as I was, to be a kid, watching, in high school, Annie Hall was such a great movie, and I think I saw it five times. So that was probably 75, I think, Annie Hall. About 8 years later, I'm writing two movies for Diane Keaton.
Aww.
And you think every now and then you pause and you think when you're in it, it's just happening. But when I reflect back on it, I think that's kind of amazing.
It must have been an amazing 8 years, because obviously
to get to that point.
Yeah. Yeah. Was, to go from sitting in the theater just like, oh, this is a cool movie, and then writing these films.
I guess, you know, it was college, and then it was film school. And film school was different in those days. There weren't hundreds of them. And, you know, I could go down a whole line talking about how I think many of them, film programs and theater programs and acting programs, are scams, actually, I think, because they promise things. They promise you a career in those fields, then the chances of that happening are very, very small. In the early 80s, when I was 78, when I moved to New York to go to Columbia University Film School, I mean, I remember... Fran Lebowitz came to speak at her school, and she said, what are you getting your degree in? And I said, film. She said, no, what are you really getting your degree in? I said, it's film. She said, that's impossible. I said, no, they actually give a degree in film. And
she honestly didn't think they did?
I think she was letting me know that she thought I was wasting my time.
Oh, got it.
That it was, but so it just wasn't as prevalent that everybody that you know and their nephew and niece are writing screenplays and pilots, and they're on YouTube, and they're making, it just wasn't what's happening. It felt very, it was adventurous and strange.
Well, and I would like to get into this conversation with you about how the industry has changed so much, because now there are so many platforms, and the need for, whether it's great content or not,
just need content.
Yeah. So there's more available, you know, opportunity than when you were first coming up, because there wasn't as much television out there.
I'm not quite sure that's exactly accurate, and not about how much there is, but you know, if somebody is a content creator, I did say that with a bit of a snide.
You did. Yeah, I caught that.
Yeah. But you know, some of them, I can't really get a job in your content. You know, it is usually self-driven, self-created. Most of it there. So people sit in, you know, so it's not the same. And actually, because there was so much less competition, so, you know, so many people were not thinking about, first of all, we weren't even thinking about social media because it didn't exist.
Right.
But weren't thinking about jobs in those areas, you know, that actually, you know, in some ways, the young talent, you were sort of a little more special. You know, so the business opened up for me, you know, in a way that I don't think it would today. I'd have to have been much more special than I actually am.
Let's get into that.
You're pretty special. I mean, yeah. I think anybody who's ever seen the movie Philadelphia would understand how brilliant a screenwriter you are. I mean, an amazing piece of film.
Thanks.
And it left an enormous impression on me when I saw that movie.
Wow. As me. Yeah.
And, you know, an incredible cast.
Yes, definitely. Certainly, we're very lucky.
When you wrote Philadelphia, who did you imagine in those roles?
Well, you know, I don't imagine actors in the roles when I write.
You don't?
No.
Because some screenwriters do. Some people like write for a specific, I want to get this person.
The danger of that is, you know, the chances of you getting that star are
pretty small.
You know, very small. So then you put something in your head that doesn't quite work and doesn't make sense. No, I just, the character is just who that character is, you know, to me. So, you know, in Philadelphia, at that point, Jonathan Demme, my mentor, and I can back up, may I back up a little
bit?
Yeah,
please. I want to take you all the way to how to get into this.
Because I tell this story sometimes to younger writers, et cetera, and potential directors, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll say, so I'm not going to tell you what happened to me, but you can never do what I did. It's not going to work. But I was living with somebody, I was at Columbia Film School, getting a master's degree. I did have this talent for screenwriting. And Milos Forman was the chairman of the department, but he was off making Hair, actually, at the time. So his colleague, a guy named Frank Danielle, who had come from Czechoslovakia as a film producer, he ran the film school, really, the master's degree program. And Frank really saw that I had a screenwriting talent. And I knew how to tell a story. I had a story instinct. And I had a way with dialogue, and he nurtured me. And I wrote my master's thesis script, which was a comedy about, and by the way, the whole thing about write what you know is the most stupid piece of advice that people give, because it's, you know, how boring. Do you, I could, should I go home and write, you, does the world really want to see a past middle-aged screenwriter as a main character in a movie? No. You know, you don't. So I was writing about somebody who wasn't like me, but who the script was set where I actually am from coal mine in Pennsylvania. And I had a roommate at the time, because that's what we called our partners.
A roommate?
Yeah. He was my roommate for, I don't know, like 17 years.
Wow.
And I wonder why mom and dad never questioned, why did every time Ron moves, he has
this guy's the same roommate.
But you know, in all honesty, my parents.
Hey, once you find somebody who pays on time.
You know, they knew. Everyone knew. We didn't have to have those uncomfortable talks. They knew. Yeah. They loved him. And his mother loved me and all that stuff. We were family. But you
never had the conversation?
Oh, I'll tell you about it. That's another story. That one, hook. That's a good one too.
Put a pin in that.
So Alan was working at the Film Society of Lincoln Center, and Melvin and Howard was a film made by Jonathan Demme, who went on for your audience to make Silence the Lambs in Philadelphia. And it was going to be the opening night film at the New York Film Festival. And Alan was a student intern, and he answered the phone one day and said, "This is Jonathan Demme. Can I speak to the director, Joanne?" And Alan did this thing, which I tell young people, you cannot do. He said, oh my God, my roommate, Ron, has written this script, and all we talk about is how you would be the perfect director for it. Would you read it? and he sighed, apparently, and then said yes. And then,
well, that's remarkable.
It's really amazing.
How did he tell you that had happened? Can you tell me that conversation?
He came home and said, I'm sending him the script. He got an address. He sent it.
And did you believe him?
Well, yeah, we sent the script.
Oh, okay.
We didn't hear from him for 3 months.
Oh.
And then one day the phone rang. And he said, "Hi, this is Jonathan Demme. Is this Ron?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "So what do you think of Nick Nolte for the lead of Love Hurts?" I said, "Sure." And he said, "Come to my apartment tomorrow," and he gave me his address, and I went, and that started this career that I had. Jonathan and I never made that movie together, which is an interesting lesson. But you know, he brought me out to Hollywood, he introduced me, and I got his agent, became my agent, and I was the hot young screenwriter.
Yeah.
I, you know, and it was very 80s, and you know, everywhere you went, people had little bottles of white powder that you would, without even asking, they would just walk up to your nose and hold.
They just assumed. It was the 80s.
It was the 80s. and it was kind of a fabulous time. It was very exciting for me. And I had, then Diane Keaton wants to meet me. And then I'm offered a book and to write something for her. And, oh, no, that was a spec script I wrote. And she got it. Mrs. Soulful that we made with Diane and Mel Gibson. So I'm having this, I'm 20, in my early 20s. And writing movies for Diane Keaton, Goldie Hawn.
So you're getting
swing
into
shift.
Swing and Shift.
Swing and Shift with Goldie.
Yeah, I'm right in the center of it, and with Jonathan, and he was such a delightful, loving person, and it was just a great way to be introduced.
And for a young man, a lot of stuff going on. You know, we talked about the white powder and a lot of other stuff going on at that time. How did you deal with all of that?
Well, you know, none of that became a problem too soon. You know, I had a... Oh, thank you. Is that better?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. I had a... Oh, I can hear it myself, actually. It's better. You know, I was raised... I really loved my parents. And I was raised in a small town, and my parents had these sort of very humane values about life and kind of very steady values. And so I wasn't immediately swept up into part. I didn't think, you know, my goal wasn't to go to what is the hottest party this weekend and how many famous people. It was all kind of amusing to me, and it was kind of amazing. And I was sitting on Goldie Hawn's bed in her bedroom in Malibu, and Warren, the phone rings, and it's Warren, and Warren's with Diane, and they're all going to come over. And you know, and it was like you sit there and you think, like, this is kind of fascinating, but you know, I also have to write these scenes that Goldie's asked me to write, and it's a job, you know.
Some people can get lost in that, though. I mean, a lot of people do, like, and they lose track that this is a job and this is what I need to do.
Well, you know, it was a thrilling job. I mean, it was the best job you could possibly have.
But you seem very grounded, and I think that, like, those values that you brought from that small town in Pennsylvania must have been a really helpful centering point.
Well, also, you know, Jonathan, again, my mentor who changed my life, he changed my life twice with a phone call. And I'll tell you about the second one in a moment, but the second phone call. But the first call, when he's called and said, what do you think of Nick Nolte for the lead? And Jonathan wasn't pursuing all that stuff. That's not who Jonathan Demme was. You know, Jonathan came from the Roger Corman School of Independent Filmmaking. And Jonathan was like a music guy, and he just liked to eat well and eat in good restaurants and have fun. He didn't pursue the glitz of it at all. You know, so I think I took my cue from him.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't about, like, can you be seen at some party talking to somebody famous? It's just like making movies that you love. You know, we loved movies. You know, this is the late 70s into the 80s. You know, it was just a love of making movies and being able to say, it was just beginning to be the era where movies were getting bigger and filled with special effects, etc. But you still could go and you could pitch a movie about this woman who, from 1901, who's, you know, helps these two murderers escape from her husband's prison, and people wouldn't look at you like you were insane. You know, they'd say, like, you know, they wouldn't say, like, Glenn, what superhero rescues them? You know?
Yeah, right.
And they end up together, right? You said, no, they're all shot to death.
What was the first movie that you fell in love with?
Wow, that's a good question. The first movie that I fell in love with, what would it be? It would probably be something on television, because it definitely was not like a Disney movie, or it wasn't all those movies that were sort of made for teens or tweens at that time. And it must have had like a Barbara Stanwyck or Betty Davis or Joan Crawford in it. And they were probably smoking cigarettes and drinking martinis and looking glamorous.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with those kinds of movies. I love drama, you know, and I love the idea that, you know, there was a world where you could just be an adult, and a sophisticated adult. You could say, you always had the right thing to say, you know, and you were witty and smart. And, you know, the movies, we tend to think that movies have gotten more sophisticated. They have in some ways. There was a sophistication to the wit and the dialogue and the intelligence of movies of the 40s and 50s. And I wanted to be those kind of witty, well-dressed people who were shooting their lovers and that sort of thing.
It's a very sophisticated thing to do.
Well, it is.
You know, or I'd be like the, you know, the neighbor, you know, who would help her clean it up. But
I, Ray Donovan.
Yeah, those are the kind of movies.
A cleaner.
I love big drama.
And so...
I want to get back to the Jonathan Demme stuff in a minute, but I'm fascinated between birth and college. Where did this come from? Where did the love for the movies? Where did that direction?
I've always been a writer.
Yeah,
I can remember in sixth grade writing the Christmas play. You know, I was the kid who was like writing these things, and then just recruiting students to be in them, but then when they found out that they'd have to practice during recess, they hated me. You know, I was always
so early on.
Creating.
Were your parents supportive of the profession direction you were headed?
You know, it's a different time. And
yes.
My parents were loving and loved me. They loved me unconditionally. But you know, in those days, your parents didn't really ask you what you were interested in. They didn't sort of, you know, take you on the college tour. My parents would think I was insane. If I said, well, you want to go see the college with me? They'd say, you're the one going. Like, do you like it, Ron? Yeah. Okay. Well, sure. That's great. I just, my college decision was me deciding, just telling my parents, I'm going to go to the University of Pittsburgh. And we might have to take out a loan for $50,000. And they said, great. You know, so there was a little bit of distance to your life in those days, which I think was kind of wonderful, because I had a world, a life that they didn't know much about, you know, and that doesn't mean I was committing crimes. I just meant I had my life, they had their lives. So we weren't as entwined.
But as your career grew, how involved did they come and watch the stuff? Did they get a chance to watch you succeed?
Well, you know, when Jonathan actually bought my first script, Love Hurts, because it was the one thing about having the conversation, but then he actually bought it. You know, my mother told me later that they paid $25,000 for it. Now, in 1982, that wasn't such a small amount, but to my father, who worked in the post office in a tiny, tiny town,
that's a lot of money.
And my mother said, your father got in the car and drove all night. He was
just thinking about it.
I was just so stirred up that I had this thing had happened. I had success of some sort. And they Yeah, they. I mean, they came to the sets and stuff occasionally. I know they came to the premiere of Philadelphia. Yeah, they certainly enjoyed it and enjoyed that it was happening.
Philadelphia obviously came at a very important time in the country, and it was a very important topic at the time it came. How are your parents about all of that?
Well, that's a story.
Okay.
And that's the second Jonathan phone call that I was telling you about. So the reason how I got involved with that movie was that, and by the way, I had, you know, people in my life. I had a very, very close relative who was struggling with AIDS at the time. And I, being in New York and being in the world that I was in, was even able to help that relative and his parents and say, there's this thing called AZT that might help with breathing and all this kind of stuff. So Jonathan called me and said, I got a call from Jonathan. We'd been out of touch for a few years, so there were three scripts that he optioned in a row. The first one, the second one was with Paul Newman, actually.
Wow.
And the third was, then he brought me to work on Swing Shift, and that didn't turn out so well. It was not
a major hit.
Wasn't a hit. Jonathan removed himself from the process at one point. So, you know, when things don't work out, you kind of pull away from people in some ways. So the couple of years with Jonathan and I just weren't in contact. And the phone rang and he said, hey, Ron, it's Jonathan. He said he had just learned that his best friend, Juan Botas, had been diagnosed. Hmm. Now, if you have to remember, before 1994 or 5, a diagnosis was pretty much a death sentence.
Absolutely, yeah.
And he said, I don't know what to do. He said, I'm terrified, but the only thing I can do is make a movie. Would you do that with me?
Oh.
I said, yes.
Wow.
And it changed my life.
Changed a lot of lives.
So that was not a film that you had written. That was something was a project that you guys did together.
No, so Jonathan and I would meet, and we were pulling articles out of newspapers and magazines, and, you know, what about this? What about this? Somehow landed on a courtroom drama, because you want stakes in it. Landed on a couple of stories about lawyers who had been fired, put together a pitch. Now, Jonathan had made, by the time I think, not quite yet, he hadn't quite yet made Silence of the Lambs, but, excuse me,
we'll edit all of it, it's going to sound great.
Oh, great, terrific. We took it as one point to Mark Platt. Mark Platt is his most recent minor success is Wicked.
I heard of it.
Oh, yeah.
Of that. Yeah. So Mark was running a studio at the time. It was Orion. It became TriStar. And we had this idea about a lawyer and the lawyer he hires to represent him in a civil rights case. And we pitched it. And those days, a pitch could be 10 minutes. And Mark said, never forget it. And I don't, this is, again, I think how the business has changed. He said, this being 1992. He said, there are 10 movies that I know of right now, 10 scripts in Hollywood in development about AIDS. All of them have heterosexual main characters. That is immoral.
Wow.
We're going to make the movie about AIDS that should be made.
And you did.
Wow.
Yeah. And the courage that it took for him to say that, and then to go to the studio and say, this is what we're doing. We're going to make a gay main character movie about AIDS. And with Jonathan, then with Silence of the Lambs coming out, there were no obstacles.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What I remember so distinctly Jason Robards.
Yeah.
In Philadelphia.
Yeah. I just remember riding the elevator with him.
Oh, that must have been something.
I'm riding the elevator with Jason Robards. And when he came to the first read-through, I said, thank you for being here. You know, really appreciate it. He said, Ron, I'd be here if you had one line.
Wow.
That's great. Yeah.
That is so cool. I mean, of course, he was a jerk in the movie. But.
Yeah. But, you know, he and Jonathan had worked together on Howard and Melvin. Melvin and Howard. And, so that was an experience, and I've had it a few times in my career where, you know, people love these stories about the movie business. It's so cutthroat, and, you know, and everyone's stabbing each other in the backs, and they're all snorting coke and getting drunk and screwing each other's partners. And yeah, maybe your fantasies, that's what it's like, you know, but my best experiences have been about love, and that movie was made in love.
Yeah.
And we loved each other.
Well, but the... immediate aftermath of the movie coming out. Obviously, it was extremely important movie, but controversial in a lot of ways.
Well, it shocked people.
Obviously, extremely shocking. The immediate feedback for yourself. Start getting a lot of calls from people saying, great, come on over, we want you to write this? Or did people kind of back away for a little while and see what was coming next?
Well, certainly no one backed away. And I was already being, I had reached a certain level of sort of in the business where people were pursuing me. So
you did Swing Shift, so.
But I was, it wasn't like suddenly I was a star in this.
Right.
It wasn't like that. I think, you asked about my parents. We had never had that conversation. That some will think is necessary. I don't necessarily. I think if everyone knows something, do you have to say it out loud? Okay. But we never had that conversation exactly. And I do remember that I was so afraid of having it. I just knew it would make them uncomfortable and I'd be uncomfortable. So I avoided it so much. And as the movie was being released, that winter, I rented a house in Key West and took my parents there for a month, and I had pre-taped an episode of Nightline with Ted Koppel. And, Philadelphia, we got a lot of press.
Yep.
I mean, I did a couple hundred interviews, I'm sure. And the first question Ted Koppel asks me is, like, so, Ron, you're gay. And I understand why, because to establish that one of the creators is gay, but I wish if I had my wits about me, I would have said, you didn't ask him if he's straight, because I was being interviewed along with Jonathan.
Oh.
And I said, yes, of course. So the night that was being aired, it was pre-taped, I was in Key West with my parents. And, I thought, oh, my God, if they read this somewhere, there's something about Philadelphia. So I made dinner reservations for them.
During that time.
For 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
Now, my parents...
Why are we eating so late? Well, there's a reason.
We used to have supper at 5.
I was just going to say, asleep for 3 hours by 10 o'clock.
It's the only reservation I can get. And I thought And then I went home a few months later, and I saw, there was a videotape in the closet that said Ron on Nightline. So a helpful neighbor obviously had presented that. But soon after that I was given an award in upstate New York, and I gave a speech, and very early in the speech talked about being a homosexual at a certain time and what that meant to me, what it meant to the film. And my parents were there. Now you're gonna make me cry, guys. And when the speech was over, people were applauding, and my parents were weeping.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Can we all take a second here?
Yeah.
They were the best.
But what I love about that story, though, is you said everyone knew. Like, the conversation wasn't really necessary.
Yeah.
And I love that. I mean, I get a sense of your parents just through that.
Yeah.
Every story that we've gotten where it's been discussed on this podcast has been a very unique situation. You're the first one to tell that particular story about this, though.
I think he's the first guest that made me cry.
Definitely.
Yeah, I have that way about me.
Yeah, that's
such a
sweet
story. It's not so good for the dating life, I have to tell you. At the first date, they're like weeping.
Awesome. So you just leave a trail of crying
trail of
people
tears.
Behind you.
Yeah.
A trail of tears.
In my dating years, if the girl was crying, I knew there was a problem.
That's right. Exactly. It wasn't a good thing.
Let's
get into the memoir.
Yeah.
That you couldn't have bared yourself any more than all of that. What caused you to want to do it, to write that book?
To write it. I joined a writer's group. Again, up in upstate New York with some really wonderful people, and I wanted to write something other than a script, a screenplay. And the truth is that, it's a memoir, but it really is a portrait of the person that I spend that time with. If you've read the book, it takes place, I think it was really 2 years, but I may have turned it into 1 year for the book. And it was a young man named Johan, and when I met him, the night I met him, that he was the most remarkable character that I might ever meet, and that I would write about him. And then when he died, and I thought, and I'd had a few years distance from that and had gotten sober because his death prompted a big climactic 2-year long dive into really dangerous drugs and alcohol and situations that I didn't, I almost didn't survive. And, you know, I knew as a couple years sober, and I knew this is the time to write about Johan. I wanted to get it down, you know, our time together. And I wanted him to be remembered because he was larger than life. Uh-huh. You know, he was the hustler with the, not with the heart of gold, but with the sharpest wit. And
did you lay it all out? Was there anything that you felt like you couldn't put into the book?
It is not a PG-rated book. And if you saw Fellow Travelers, you know that I don't shy away from those things.
Yeah.
It's not. But it, what it is, I think what saves it, because you know, everybody's writes memoirs, and usually that I was born and this happened. What saves it, it's really about those 2 years of a love story between two very different people who have this bizarre relationship. And he was so, so funny, you know, and until the tragedy, the climax is that story, we had crazy adventures. I mean, you know, I... strolling down Hollywood Boulevard looking for a crack dealer named Gestapo, you know, who sold
us. Did you find him?
He sold us fake rocks. Yeah, but then we had to go into like the pipe store to get to make a homemade pipe. It was like, you know, and the whole time I'm being this beautiful, sexy blonde guy who is smarter than any person I have ever met without. He spoke 5 languages. Wow. And he was a hustler. He was a prostitute. And that dichotomy fascinated me.
I bet.
And he was an orphan. And he also, I don't know if you read the book, but he lied about everything he ever told me.
Yeah. I have not, but I will. Now I'm going to.
Now I can't wait. I mean, my God, this sounds like...
Yeah, let's not read it together, though. Yeah. We'll be crying the whole time.
Oh, no, I hope you'll be laughing.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I do like to say, I think my book has the funniest suicide attempt perhaps ever recorded, so... There you go.
Well, if you can't laugh about that.
Yeah, what can you laugh? You have no sense of humor.
Well, Patrick knows. I've been in about 3 stage productions in town. And 2 of them have been about suicide, and 1 of them I was a hospice patient. So
oh,
bunch of comedies.
Laughs, yeah.
He did this play. It was all real suicide letters.
Do you know Stan Zimmerman?
No.
He wrote for the Golden Girls, and he wrote... It's very moving.
Yeah.
It's terrific. But I didn't know. Randy reached out and says, hey, I'm doing this play and they're going to do a Q&A afterwards. Would you moderate the Q&A? I said, sure, of course. It's your first time on. I would be honored. That would be great. Mm-hmm. Then I found out what it was. And I'm like, oh, my God. Like, yeah. It's a feel-good hit of the summer. This is how I'm going to spend my Sunday afternoon.
Yeah,
he hasn't returned any of my calls since.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
But it was very, you know, it was very moving, and it was very, and Stan is also one of those guys who's really funny.
And he wrote that as a result of somebody extremely close to him killing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that led him into this play. And it turned out to be a play about just nothing of suicide notes from people. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty moving.
It was remarkable how he put it all together. I mean, like when you told me what it was, I'm like, how does that become a play? But I mean, these are real. Yeah. Suicide. But it was, and it prompted a great post-play conversation too.
It
was a gift, not necessarily one that I wanted, but it was a gift.
Well, just for your audience and my pitch, who want to buy my memoir called Blue Days, Black Nights, A Memoir of Desire, it actually attempts to be as amusing and entertaining as possible. So just so you know.
That's all right.
It's heading toward a dark place, but it...
Oh, we got a lot of laughs in the suicide play, too. Yeah. I remember that.
Well, so.
It's both sides of the emotions, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No.
I read recently that Philadelphia is being entered into the National Film Registry?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? Tell us how you knew that was going to happen.
I know as much as you do.
Oh, you do?
Somebody just sent forward me the article. They didn't contact us. But
That's a pretty big deal.
Kept in perpetuity, you know, preserved in perpetuity. So it's an honor. It's great films and that we're included with. And these things happen that, you know, our careers are so much, for the most part, luck in a way. You know, that I met Jonathan the way I met him, and you know, and that we came together at a particular time, and that movie was just the right thing that needed to be done. So you only feel. You know, I think if you're arrogant, you feel proud. If you're humble, you feel grateful.
Yeah. I want to talk about Homeland.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yes, you do.
I mean, that was one of those...
Hang on just a second. Honey, we're about to talk about Homeland. Go ahead. That's for my wife.
She doesn't listen.
Oh, it's for your wife.
Oh, she also doesn't listen. That series fascinated me from episode one.
Yeah.
And my wife, we were the same way. Like, we were just totally hooked. You were in season, you were executive producer.
I was a co-producer, writer. I was in the room. I was one of the writers, basically. But in television, writers are also producers.
Gotcha.
And in television especially, you tend to produce your own episodes. So you go on set.
And which, so season?
5, 6, and 7.
5, 6, and 7.
Yeah, so Berlin, and then we were in New York, and then she was back in Washington, D.C. for episode 7. And I have a couple of benchmarks. My first episode, I got to kill 17 people.
Congratulations.
I know, I'm very proud of that.
I mean, if you're going to kill people, go for a big
one
number.
One of them was a teenage girl whose only crime was to fly to Switzerland to have her appendix removed. She happened to be on the wrong plane when the Russian, bad Russian lady blew it up.
Oh.
Yeah, I was very proud of that. But that experience was another example of, you know, how good art comes from love, because that the writer's room on Homeland. Do people talk about writer's rooms much? Do people know?
People know writer's room. I think
a little bit. Yeah,
and we've had a number of people who. So yeah, writer's room should, with our audience. They're very sophisticated.
You know, every day you go to work and you sit. You know, now a lot of it's on Zoom, which is unfortunate. But you sit in a room with, and on Homeland, notoriously very smart. You know, you're sitting in a room with not only people who are so smart about politics and the world situation, but some of them have been writing television for decades, and some of them have worked together for many, many years on different shows. They, you know, a lot of them came from 24. And Alex Gans and Howard Gordon, who created the show, were so loving and welcoming, but the show was you pitch in a writer's room. So, you know, you just pitch. You know, if you pitch,
you're throwing out ideas.
If the first 20 ideas don't work, you better have 21. In that room, when the people are really smart, and you know, the pitches can hit the ground really fast. You know, fall.
Yeah.
Basically, because sometimes you get just halfway through a sentence and you see somebody's face and you think, I should just stop now. I should just stop now.
Now would be good. Sooner would have been better.
But really, it was a loving kind of discipline, and it was really exciting. And
well, you stepped in at that point. I mean, this incredibly well-established and just this great show that was firing on all cylinders.
Seasoned cast.
Yeah. Yeah, so that must have been a really great experience, but also kind of daunting, I would imagine.
Well, was it daunting? Well, they were so welcoming. I wasn't really that nervous. I mean, perhaps I've always had this, like, inferiority complex that sort of is combined with arrogance. So
that's a weird guess.
So, you know, I what's the worst going to happen? They fire me. But
and I'll get another job.
It didn't really feel like that. It was pretty fascinating right from the start. And, you know, one of the things that they did was every season begins with a trip, like a school trip, like to Washington, D.C., where we would sit in this place for 3 or 4 days, and we had consultants and people come to us from the FBI, the CIA, from all walks of the government. We had Mike Hayden, who had been the National Security Advisor. You know, we had the Chief of Station from London. I mean, we had lots of people who come, and it all was off the record, and we were never supposed to tell people exactly who was there. And
I imagine they kind of love coming in and sitting down and
people love talking about the show.
Yeah,
well, the
chief
of station from London started when he came. He said, "Look, guys, just want you to know, guys, that you know, in my colleagues, you know, the CIA meets with, is it MI5 or MI6? Yeah, every Monday there's the joint meeting, and the first 20 minutes are about Homeland."
That's so awesome.
Yeah, it's so great.
The show. I mean, I don't know that world particularly well, obviously, but it seemed like it was very realistic, that like you guys really did understand what you were writing about.
Yeah, well, it was deeply, deeply researched. But, you know, realistic is not quite what would make good drama, because realistic is really
boring.
You know what? And I'm writing a CIA show now for Netflix. And, you know, the reality is that CIA officers mostly meet in hotel rooms and talk. And it takes months, if not years, of trying to turn an asset or something. It takes this long process, you know, and you know, there aren't, there you're not often confronted with a bomb and a kidnapping and all that kind of stuff. So obviously there are more events in Homeland than there are right. in most people's lives.
Well, thank goodness. I mean, if it was, of course, if real life was as eventful as Homeland, we'd be in trouble.
Television is about trauma. But, you know, it was just great to sit there, to be on the set with Claire Danes and Mandy.
So intense. Is she that intense in real life?
She's just a doll. She's just so lovely. And it was amazing. I remember like my first episode with her, we're in Berlin in the parking lot of the Olympic Stadium, where we've rigged up, it's a car shot, where they've rigged up a green screen. It was just there at the Olympic Stadium because they had a big parking lot. And they have this car that's all taken apart. And Carrie is driving, allegedly, and Quinn has been shot, and he's in the passenger seat, and they're being fired at by Russians. And, you know, and they're, you know, and Claire's just being very welcoming. She's sitting next to me behind the monitors and saying, like, so you're from upstate New York, and like, you know, and they said, Claire, we're ready for you. And she gets in, and the DP is saying, so Claire, your left hand on the steering wheel an inch down, your right hand on Quinn's
continuity.
Can you go down? Yeah. Well, not so much for his angle.
Oh, I got it. Okay.
Can you just go, can you cheat it? You're not touching the wound. And then, okay, action. And you watched her, and suddenly she's driving away from Russians who are shooting at her. And then they say, cut. And she comes back over and she said, you know, I've been to upstate New York. And you think,
that's an actor.
Yeah. That's an actor, that they have that discipline and that skill level to do
that's
that.
It's really impressive.
It was so impressive.
Watching that show, what she goes through, what her character goes through, I just think, wow, she's got to be tough to hang out with. But it's really
Claire.
You know, no. Claire, impossible
the
to
most,
hang out.
Yeah. But I would. Carrie's not your number one date.
Number two, maybe, not number one.
Yeah,
but Mandy, Mandy.
There was a time in my life where that would have been the number one date.
Yeah,
yeah,
going for the crazy.
I understand that for sure. But they were all really, really delightful, and we did try to be as smart as possible, and it was kind of exhausting, and we all loved each other, and it was all really fun. And I was the guy, you know, they were all the time, they knew everybody's name in the Middle East and all that kind of stuff. And I would say, so like, I have this bitch, like, so that bad guy from Iraq, like, I can't remember which one or which, you know, but you know, so I was always like, I was never sort of the political guy, but I was the guy who said, what if a social worker comes and takes Carrie's baby away?
Wow.
So I got to do so that was the plot of episode 6, if you remember, and 7. And so I
can't wait to get home.
Yeah. And not only we didn't just do an episode about it, we did two seasons.
Yeah.
About it. Yeah. So that's sort of my expertise, was sort of to be that guy.
Are there any projects that you've always had in the back of your mind and you just can't seem to finish it up or get it out there, but it's something you keep coming back to?
Yes, but I don't know if I want to tell them now, because actually I don't want to give someone else the idea. But, you know, Fellow Travelers, I developed, it was a 10-year, 12-year long process. That doesn't mean every day and every week and every even year I'm thinking about it. But I read the book, I would say 10 years before I went back to it. And I just happened to be talking to somebody. I can tell the story of how that came up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you won a Peabody Award for Fellow Travelers, right?
And another Emmy nomination.
Another Emmy nomination.
And lots of other awards and nominations.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I would like to hear that story.
Being very humble, I just want to make clear that I won my second Peabody
Award
for Fellow Travelers and got my second Emmy nomination. But, you know, who's counting?
That's it. I'm done with research. I'm horrible at it.
Second Peabody. Just remember that. The second. What was your first Peabody for?
It's called a movie called Soldier's Girl. It was on Showtime, and it was a 2003, and it was about a true story, a true crime, true story, with a transgender main character and her boyfriend who had been beaten to death by his fellow soldiers at Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Right.
It was called the Don't Ask, Don't Tell murder.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wrote about that and won a Peabody Award for that. And it was, there was an Emmy nomination, there were a few Golden Globe nominations. So that was,
that was great. Do you still get a little, it's pretty cool, I just got a nomination. Does that do anything for you?
Well, you just talked about it, so.
Yeah, it's better than not getting it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sure.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. It's really it is kind of fun. And yes, yeah, so what was I about to tell you?
You were going to tell me the story about fellow travelers.
Yes, so fellow travelers. I don't know how much well you guys know it, but you know it's about these two men who meet. The novel is about these two men who meet in 1953 in Washington, D.C., during the period of the Lavender Scare, which everybody is more familiar with the Red Scare, when, you know, people were being either falsely or sometimes rightly accused of having belonged to the Communist Party, and their lives were being destroyed.
The Lavender Scare was a different topic.
The Lavender Scare was on the same executive order, the same, but it was people being being outed as homosexual,
right,
and having to, which would be immediate firing. And, you know, not only being firing, but you would, especially if you were outed, you were publicly branded a sexual pervert, and you would never get it. So say you've studied government, politics, you have a degree in languages, et cetera, et cetera. You would never get a teaching job. You would never get a job in politics. You know, and there was a rocket scientist, a guy who was ready to go to work on our space program, who was branded, and he has spent his life as a janitor. So that was what was happening. So there's a love story. So we put a love story in all that because it has high stakes, which is like what we like to do. And then I read the book. I was kind of fascinated by it. Every now and then I would mention it to somebody. I had people say things to me like, Ron, it's period, it's politics, and it's gay. And somebody said to me, it's period, politics, it's gay. Don't you want to make money in this business? No one's ever going to make that. And the great Robbie Rogers, who he and his husband Greg have a house out here, Greg Berlanti, was talking to, had dinner with him one night, and I told him about fellow travelers. And I gave him the book, and he took it home, and he told Greg about it, and he called me, and he said, so, Ron, because I was under contract to another entity at that time, he said, if you're not going to make this, Greg says he'll set it up at his company at Warner Brothers in 24 hours. And I said, I can't work for Warner Brothers. I'm under contract to another company. But I went back to that company, to that president, who's now a really good friend of mine, Dante DiLoretto, and I said, Greg Berlanti wants to do this. And he said, you know, Ron, what, that's not pushing me to do it. What's pushing me to do it is your passion for it. And I believe in passion.
Yeah.
And that, I'm just going to sound like an old cranky person. I'm afraid that that's what's leaving the business.
Passion?
Yes. Fellow Travelers was made because people like Dante and Gary Levine, who was the president of Showtime at the time, loved it. That's why it was made. Yeah. I mean, Gary developed it with me for a year and a half through writer's rooms and multiple scripts. And then he had to go just one stop upstairs. And he had finally, after working on the scripts and all that stuff, Matt being cast, not having Jonathan Bailey yet, and Gary said, I'm going to go upstairs and talk to David Nevins. And that
walk upstairs.
Yeah, that's, I don't know if that's happening anymore. No. I think there are large committees who have to run algorithms and data and all that kind of stuff.
That was my question. What is sucking the passion out of the business?
Fear.
What's the fear?
The fear is as an executive, I'll have convinced the company to make something that fails. Mm. And
and that sticks with.
And the whole business is contracting, so they're always looking for people to fire. So it's fear, and it's finding comfort, because you can always say, yeah, but the data said this should have worked. But, you know, so that's where I fear. I mean, I still am working with great executives. They're people at Netflix I adore and stuff like that, who have great taste and passion. But, you know, there's this, and also what's happening is the consolidation of the businesses is just so sad.
Yeah, and it's happening so fast.
It's
happening at every level.
Yeah, there are going to be like four companies left that make stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like at this tiny little, here in Palm Springs, once upon a time, there were three major network affiliates.
Yeah.
There are not.
No.
No, we're down to two.
No.
And I would say one's on shaky legs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not mine.
No, yeah. Not yours.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the consolidation is really scary. You know, it means less jobs. It means less creativity, fewer voices.
Yeah.
Well, and angst on a daily basis because you can't feel comfortable that your job's going to be in place the next day.
But guys, I got a great pension coming to me from my union.
Yeah.
So I actually don't have that angst.
There's not a lot of podcast pension coming in right now. Oh, you getting yours?
McMullen told me I'm taking care of it.
You guys are good. That's why at my age I'm still having to do this.
Yeah. John said I could quit tomorrow. He said my lifestyle would improve.
It would, because you won't be facing me. Let me ask. So
sure.
This kid in this 500 people town in Pennsylvania. And eventually you're sitting on in front of all of these people that we all know and love. Do you sit back at this point in your life and just sit back for a minute and go, oh my gosh, how did that kid get here?
I don't wonder, I don't sort of analyze it.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm incredibly sort of moved by it. I mean, it's an incredible adventure. I mean, I not only did John Woodward appear in one of my movies, Paul Newman, who I grew up with, my mother, that was my mother's, like, she was obsessed with Paul Newman. You know, she's like, he's so handsome. She just loved
me
him.
Too.
Anyway, yeah, he was great. And he was great. You know, I was, in, you know, I worked with him for 2.5 years on a project with Jonathan. You know, I was in his house. I actually delivered a script in those days. There was before email. You literally physically took a new draft. I took it up to Paul in the Carlisle Hotel. And he answered the door on crutches in his boxer shorts. And he said, oh, Ronnie, come on in, come on. And I said, here's a new draft. And he said, yeah, that's great. He said, listen, these Japanese businessmen are coming here for like lunch because they want me to do some commercial. And he said, there's nobody here. And you see that rolled up rug over there? Could you unroll it? I said, yeah. He said, you see that little table over there? Could you put it on the rug?
I guess if Paul Newman asked you to do that.
And he said, there, could you go in the kitchen, in the refrigerator, are the appetizers? Would you set them?
Well, he was on crutches, for God's sake. So you got to help him out.
It was so great. It was one of the great days of my life. Are you kidding? That's when you're thinking, like, how would I have known that I would be, like, setting out appetizers for Paul Newman, who's on crutches in his boxer shorts.
Boxers.
You know, and then actually, and then Joanne is, like, in my movie, like, 4 years later. And at the premiere, I introduced my mom from coal mining, Pennsylvania, to Joanne Woodward.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, and my mother's, this is what my mother says. Instead of saying, oh, Joanne, you know, I've loved all your movies, Three Faces Eve, you know, my mother says, where's your handsome husband?
Probably not the first time Joanne heard that. That would have been my mom's first question, too.
Joanne left. Yeah.
All right, you mentioned that you're working on a CIA thing.
I am. It's called The Quantum Spy. Would you like to know more?
Yes.
Quantum, I want to know more.
Well,
go ahead.
I shouldn't talk too much about it because it's just in development. But it's based on a novel by David Ignatius, who, you know, is a big, very famous, very prolific, and very talented, smart writer about these things. You know, as I did with Fellow Travelers, admired the book of Fellow Travelers very much, but there's a lot in my television show that isn't in the book because drama has different requirements than books do. So there's a lot of stuff in The Quantum Spy that is not in Mr. Ignatius' book, and I'm not sure how he's going to feel about that. but, you know, we'll see.
And what else is in the pipeline for you?
Not much, Patrick.
I think it's a story about two podcast hosts.
That would grip the nation.
Yeah, there's zero drama in that.
I do have a documentary. You know, I produce documentaries sometimes. I had one on HBO a few years ago that I'm very proud of called Murder on Middle Beach, which we were very successful with. And it's a true 4-part true crime. And there's a documentary that's we're premiering at the Tribeca Film Festival. Jeffrey Schwartz is the filmmaker. He's been a chronicler of gay history for decades. And it's called Mineshaft, The Cruising Murders. And it's about the real murders behind the movie Cruising.
Wow.
And the making of the movie Cruising, which I don't know if you remember, if you're familiar.
No.
But it caused, the gay community was up in arms because the script had been passed around and a lot of people thought, well, you're showing these leather bars and these sex bars and you're showing this dark side of our culture and, you know, isn't life hard enough for us? And I have to tell you, At that time, I was on that side, and I actually participated in some of the protests. Eventually, thousands of people came out to protest. One time, we sat down on Fifth Avenue and just stopped traffic. And I was in a movie theater around this time, seeing a bad Woody Allen movie. I think Sex, Midsummer Night's Sex Comedy.
Oh, yeah.
The bad one. And I was leaving early with my partner at the time. We were not, and he went into, we came out, and we were not holding hands. We had done nothing. We were just like two guys seeing a movie. But for some reason, the ushers nailed us as gay, and they started threatening us. And they then started chasing us. And they said, if you saw the movie Cruising, you know what you deserve.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. That was pretty scary. We called the management the next day. You know what the management said? You must have been, were you kissing in the theater? I said, no. And she said, you must have done something to set them off. That's what life was like in the early 80s, folks.
Wow.
Anyway, so those protests, I understand about Cruising, although I also am the big fan of William Friedkin. I think he's a great artist. And I do think artists have the right to make the movies that they need to make. So it's, and the movie embraces those points of view. And a lot of gay activists now, it's very interesting, gay critics are have revised their opinions about the movie. It's a very fascinating movie to see where yeah. it sort of stands now in terms of what people think it is and what
yeah.
it does. But it's a really exciting time. And, you know, the murderer, there's a fascinating detail, which I'll share with you. In The Exorcist, do you remember when the little girl goes and gets a spinal tap?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The nurse, they used real doctor and nurse to do it. It's a really special procedure. The nurse, and you'll notice he's wearing kind of like little leather wristbands, which is kind of William Friedkin thought was interesting. And William Friedkin said, don't just wear what you're wearing. And that was the murderer. That was the Cruising murderer.
Really?
He's in William Friedkin's movie.
OMG.
And then William Friedkin ends up making...
making the movie.
Yes. And that his murderer is in... He already shot... was in The Exorcist. Isn't that crazy?
Goosebumps.
Yeah.
That's the craziest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. So it's my... Mine Chef, The Cruising Murders. You know, we're looking for... talking to distributors now and premiering at the Tribeca Film Festival. So I'm very excited about that.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Wow.
This is one of those that we could go on a lot longer, I feel like.
I don't... I think this is more emotions than we've had on one show. Very possibly.
Gee.
Well, thank you.
Is that good or bad?
It's
no,
great.
Rod, it's
no,
really
this
good.
Is, this is,
you know. John told me one time as a podcast host, he said, if you can get him to cry, it's gold. But what he didn't say was what happens
you to
if
cry.
I start crying.
Yeah, like if you get the host to cry.
Yeah, I know. That parent's crying
that was,
story
that was,
gets him every time.
That was yeah. That's a good story.
Yeah.
You know, well, no, we
wheeled
like,
that one out.
We certainly look back, Randy and I, over the 100, nearly 50 episodes we've done. And like there are benchmarks, some low benchmarks and high benchmarks. And you just set a very high benchmark.
Oh, thanks.
You
thanks did. So
thank
much.
You.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Fascinating, fascinating time with you.
Thanks. Thanks so much, guys.
It was
you know,
great to
I,
have you.
I consider
you.
This a welcome to the desert.
Oh, and hopefully that's what it ends up being.
Yeah, I'm here.
I left soon after I met with Randy and Patrick.
I mean, it could go either way. You could tell
I
people.
Got in the car, drove back. I never turned back.
I didn't even go back home.
Yeah, just drove that. Called the real estate agent on the way out. Sell that place.
And here I am in Santa Monica now. And
No, I love it here. I love it. Love it. I'm a citizen of Palm Springs.
Good.
Not officially yet, but I hope to be.
I'm glad you were here. Thanks for sticking with us to get on this show.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
This was terrific. Thank you, Ron. I guess thank you, Randy.
Thank you, Patrick.
Great job. Always great job doing research.
Nice to see you get a little emotional today.
That was an emotional story.
Well, I bet you're not drinking. It's a hot toddy. That's it. The emotion came from our guest.
There might be a couple shots in that glass that we didn't
there
see.
Are a couple.
She might have spiked it.
No,
possibly.
The emotion definitely comes from our guest.
No doubt about it.
John McMullen, thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
And thanks again, for getting this guest, John.
Congratulations on your Seahawks victory.
Michael Childers. I said thank you to Michael Childers.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Michael and yes.
made the introduction. Yeah.
And congratulations on your Seahawks.
Hey, San Francisco's got a good shot at it. Not next year.
Every year.
One year. Yes, one year. All right. Well, our thanks to Skip Page and his entire team at Little Bar. They always make us feel very welcome. And we just so enjoy opportunities
guys.
To do something like this. It was
You
really
can see
special.
How shy and reticent I am.
Yeah.
Yes,
we'll have you back and then ask you to open up a little bit.
That's right. Yeah.
All right, folks.
Thank
be
you
sure
guys.
To subscribe so you never miss another episode of Big Conversations, Little Bar.
Big Conversations, Little Bar is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System. This podcast is available in audio and video format. Visit our website at www.bigconversationslittlebar.com. New episodes are released every Monday.
Athletes and dreamers, stars of the screen, leaders and builders, and all in between. Conversations, Little Bar, at Big Conversations, Little Bar.